Thank you. I wanted to talk about attachment. So we read about attachment as being a big problem in Buddhism and Zen. I was looking at the Sung San book, Dropping Ashes on the Buddha, and he gives an example. This is an apple. You say it's an apple, you're attached to name and form. You say it's not an apple, you're attached to emptiness. And I didn't say it there, but just to make the point that you're not allowed to choose either of those things in other places. It's you will be hit 30 times if you choose either of those. Attachment. Last winter, during Kulche, we studied the 12-link chain of dependent origination and attachment. I think it's number 8 of the chain. Number 9, right after desire, and then suffering at the end of it. So that's a big problem. But I'm interested in how we take these Buddhist ideas that originally came down in Sanskrit or Pali words and have translated those to words that we're more familiar with. And they're usually pretty good matches, but sometimes we have other uses for these words, and it doesn't always work. We are pretty familiar with conventionally with attachment problems. So think about hoarding, for example. People really attached to stuff, or just some people being very materialistic and attached to money or material things, or addictions, or another example of where we might get really attached to an experience and have trouble with it. But it also has really positive connotations in other places. We sometimes use the word attached as another synonym for being married, and usually thinking of that as a positive thing. And I was going to mention, Lisa said, mentioned I am a child psychiatrist, so had a lot of education about child development, and one of the pioneers of child development was a man named John Bowlby, who wrote a book in 1969 called Attachment, and it was really groundbreaking because it was based on a lot of actual research. Before that, the tradition was to develop very elaborate ideas about child development just based on talking with adult patients and figuring out what must have happened for them to get to where they are then, and maybe observations of people's own children too along the way. But John Bowlby had a colleague named Mary Ainsworth, who did a lot of really some of the first systematic observation of children to develop these ideas about how kids attach to a primary figure. It's very selective attachment, and it's very important. It parallels a lot of animal research with monkeys a decade earlier about how normal development really requires this attachment stage. And if you think about it, it would be pretty important for survival that not just the parent is worried about a little one wandering off, that it's nice to have that little one, have it be very important to them to stay close to that protective attachment figure. And then he developed his theories in a way, talking about how that became foundational for how we experience ourselves and relationships as we get into adulthood. So going back to this idea that Zen and Buddhism sometimes has this very negative connotation of attachment, I imagine this somebody coming back from their first day at the Zen Center telling their partner, we just learned a whole lot about we need to give up our attachments and let go of likes and dislikes. It's like, oh, that sounds very interesting. You're not going back there. So I think that Zen sometimes comes under attack as some many traditional religions as having all this language about getting rid of desires and being repressive of emotion and not really recognizing some basic human emotional needs. But well, that's probably not true. the other quote from John Bowlby that's pretty famous is, life is best organized as a series of daring ventures from a secure base. And he wrote a book called A Secure Base, I think it was. So other, you know, another important aspect of that theory is that there's this critical period between ages of 1 and 2 when this occurs. And after that, it's not possible to get that same basic foundation. And what happens with those early experiences is they become something he called an internal working model. So as we get older, teenagers really start to develop this ability to think about other possibilities than what is, sort of hypothetical situations and other scenarios. And so this internal working model really starts to develop and become very elaborate, and we sort of incorporate everybody in our life and characters from books and movies and be able to have these internal dialogues and spend quite a lot of time there. And that teenagers are described as self-absorbed, and maybe that's what they're doing with a lot of that time. In recent years, there's a lot of interest in artificial intelligence and virtual reality, I think we all kind of carry that on. We are trying to create with machines something that we do all the time with our minds, I think. I remember first being struck by a story about this kind of simulation of reality with computers. Back in 1995, 96, there was a news story about right before most of the nations in the world were going to sign this comprehensive nuclear test ban, the French undertook to start doing a series of tests to get right before the deadline. And they were criticized for doing this. And their argument for why we shouldn't be bothered by it was that they were going to use the data to make a computer simulation. And with that, they wouldn't need to test anymore. They could use that to develop their weapons in the future. And so it seemed like a little bit missing some of the main points as far as why we would want to stop testing. In addition to sort of the sense that this is going on and being frightening for people, I think there's the kind of naive hope that if people stop testing, it means they stop thinking about how to make even more destructive weapons. And so, in any case, so this idea of the internal working models and simulated reality that I think matches what in Zen we call small I. We start to carry it around with us wherever we go, and use it. And for teenagers, it maybe is safer. They start to get some dangerous ideas, and if they can test them out in the simulation, maybe that's a little bit safer. And then they graduate from high school, and we tell them, follow your dreams, and so they're really working on sort of what they want to do, and they don't have a chance to, you know, try out all these jobs, so they have to kind of imagine and use cues from TV shows and things like that. Yeah, I think I would want to do that. But eventually I think we find this simulation kind of limiting. There are some well-known problems with how our minds work in terms of what what's called confirmation bias now, and being kind of closed to new information, and we don't want to be constantly revising our simulation. We want to get it perfect, and so when things change, it really bothers us, and it's kind of kind of a foggy filter that interferes with our being able to really encounter the world. We're talking to somebody and thinking about what we think they're going to say, and maybe they say something different. We may not even hear that. We hear what we're playing, or we miss the sunset because we're thinking about sort of their task list back at home. So it's a problem, and I think that Zen offers us kind of a solution, that we have a way to cut off this thinking, and it gets described that, but I guess if I'm lucky, my experience is if I wait long enough, it kind of might enter sleep mode temporarily, and then it wakes back up. But I mean, if I were to restate Bowlby's quote that maybe life is best organized as a series of daring adventures, starting from a place of don't know mind, once we've cultivated the ability to find that. And so, yeah, that's pretty much all I have to say about attachment. Thank you.
That was really interesting. I really appreciate your perspective from your professional background and your long Zen background. I just open it up to questions, comments, and also feel free to badger Jim. and anything that anyone would like to bring up? It's very interesting and stimulating. Yes.
When I was thinking of attachment, I was thinking of attachment in the traditional sense. I was also thinking of like Zen and how a lot of things that are taught in Zen as like these koans, I find not useful. And some of these things are like this, like, oh, you know, attach, don't attach, either way you get hit 30 times, like I still don't get it. So, but anyways, my interest is like, also because of the psychiatrist kind of field that you were coming from, is like attachment is related to instinct. Because I feel like it's true, like everything that you grow up really like shapes your world and how you react to certain people. And how do you take Zen and make it useful for like I trust my instinct and I want to trust my instinct. And I feel like meditating has made my instinct and the courage to trust my instinct stronger. But I can still see some of the little things of like attaching to like things that are not useful from being young. So maybe like not a secure base. So I don't know what my question is, but I think
I hear a question in there. This is like, you know, and it's a big one, I think, really, about this instinct, trusting your instinct or your gut feeling or something. I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of what we call karma mixed up in there. And that is a kind of habit energy, a kind of habit attachments to a certain way of thinking, like, I don't like koans. I don't see what they're good for. For example, so that certain, we sort of track ourselves in certain ways, and that becomes a habit. And so then it gets a little bit muddy, it gets a little confusing. Is this my instinct that to trust, or is this my habit energy?
But then there's a lot of doubt, and then you have to walk around doubting everything.
So Jim's point about finding that foundation point from which to leap, from which to have faith, have trust, is don't know mind. it's our, you know, coming back to clarity. When in doubt, in the sense of being unsure, is this true? Is it not true? Is this habit energy? Is it attachment energy? Let go of all that arises in your mind. All. Even those, you know, preciously held opinions. You know, one, it just, if I could just address one thing about this attachment and how tricky it is. You know, you brought up a very important point about language and how tricky it is to grasp, to really understand what that's pointing to, this concept of attachment. And, you know, I'm also, I think it's important to help us understand that, to understand what could be really understood as a positive form. It's not necessarily bad or good. First point of reference is it clear? Is it clear? So you were talking about the 12 link chain, and you know the step just before attachment. As soon as there's desire, there is leaning. And as soon as there's leaning, there is an agenda. And it has a label. Often, I like, I don't like. And those are attachments. Those are attachments. So desire in the sense of, it's almost like wanting to solidify something that cannot ultimately be grasped. Changing, 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 changing. Why do we imprison ourselves? Just on the cusp of feeling. So let go of all your attachments so that you can attain this spacious awareness, which is in a way, and to phrase it in a positive way, a commitment to all that appears, a commitment. We say, you know, sentient beings are numberless. We vow to save them all. We vow to assist, to open our hearts to all. That's big attachment mind. Big commitment, big love.
But everything starts with desire and attachment.
Everything starts with don't know. Yeah, so come back, come back.
Thank you.
Another? Or maybe you would like to add something?
No, that's great.
Something, any questions?
I have heard the perspective of don't go trying to shed your attachments, just understand what you're getting yourself into. What I mean by that is, you know, interconnection and attachment does seem to be just a daily facet of our lives. But believing that something's either going to last forever, or does not go away, you're creating a trap for yourself for the eventual change. But if you know that's coming, and if you're happy to make that, or if you're willing to make that sacrifice,
Where's the sacrifice?
Well, any connection that you make is eventually lost, right? So there is a kind of letting go or a sacrifice in that, is that something comes and then it goes, right?
It's an interesting word. I sort of tease that out a little bit more, because if you say sacrifice, it means that you're losing something, that you're giving up something.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So that's creating an idea already in front of experience.
Well, let me see if I can sum it up simply.
If I could, you know, just to go back a little bit to an earlier statement you made, which I think is really wonderful. I don't remember how you phrased it, but it reminded me of our sort of order of operations in Zen training, which is, first attain or touch, experience this don't know mind, this before thinking mind. Then it becomes possible to see clearly. You said something about seeing what you're getting into.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we could say in terms of Zen, if our minds are clear, then we can see clearly. And from that perspective, find our fitting function. So nowhere in there is there a rule that you should subscribe to behaviors A, B, C, D, and then you'll get X, Y, Z results or something. So the foundation, again, is don't know. From which we can see clearly.
What I just have in mind is, for instance, like in romance, that is making attachment, and there is...
Is it?
Well, most people would say there's pain if it goes away, right? And that's usually one of the primary symptoms of attachment, is that it hurts when it stops, right? That's usually how that process is described.
Sometimes it's great relief.
Yeah, or there's that too, for sure. Yeah. Or don't we all know? Yeah. So I can just see
the capacity
to go running away from things lest a person becomes attached to things.
Oh. Yeah, all of this is a lot of thinking. that when you think about love, you love someone, what does that have to do with attachment? Period. You have a family. You could even have a contract saying you're married, but nevertheless, what does that have to do with attachment? Any other questions?
Well, to follow up though, at the beginning of your statement, I thought, where you're going was interesting. It's one thing to attach or not attach, but it seems part of nature in some ways. Mm-hmm. You started out talking about on a daily basis, we seem to desire, attach, detach. But there's a difference between trying to say, I won't attach, versus just recognizing this is to see clearly that my nature is probably to desire and to attach, but to see it versus trying to change our nature, although our true nature is don't know why, or that's the base. Mm-hmm. But I thought where you were trying to go is, it's not necessarily why. I remember the very first time I asked the question of Jim on a hike, is Zen about detachment? And he said, I don't think that's the right term. Mm-hmm. It's about attachment or not attachment. But it's, I was thinking of the difference between, as we talk about the the components of the 12 link chain. I think the thing that has struck me is it's not that, it's more a recognition of this is either a trap or these are things that we frequently end up doing. And the way to not be doing it, but to be aware is also a part of being awake and being in the moment and recognizing that these are frequently the things that create the karma or the background of, you know, the experiences and the attachments that we form, you know, kind of the traps that we fall into, maybe. Mm-hmm. So, I think I'm still not, the thing I'm not clear about is, as you said, at the beginning, there are lots of, in English, the words attachment and the theories about attachments are connoted with both good and bad. Bad attachments are a drug, an addiction, or some attachment to money or something, and good attachments are, we recognize out of, you know, psychology of, you know, what's maybe necessary for a good base for an infant to grow into an adult is to have a good experience of attachment. But so here within Zen, I still don't, I think what I'm coming to and I want a confirmation of, attachment is neither good or bad. Mm-hmm. Attachment is. Mm-hmm. We have to recognize that it exists.
Yeah. Here's your confirmation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
it's not good or bad, it's not like, don't like, it's a recognition that attachment is something that we as beings do regularly. Or,
yeah. Okay. And, you know, back to your earlier comment about asking Jim about, well, is Zen about being detached?
Right.
And, you know, that's a common misconception with it a lot of people have. And, you know, the phrase that we often use here is spacious awareness, so that there's wide, open awareness. I just, you know, your comments, I don't know, prompted me to give a little example to illustrate this that happened to me yesterday when I was stuck in traffic on Mercer. What do they call it? The Mercer Madness at rush hour.
Yes.
I spent half an hour on one block.
Right.
And you know, just my husband was sitting next to me, and I could feel this kind of irritation. It's like this. I'm just going to get all the attachments, you can say, all the disturbances in the field were coming to the foreground.
Right.
And so what I could see, and again, it's the seeing of it that dissipates the energy behind these feelings. Feelings are not bad, feelings are not good, they're just feelings. There's just our humanity, we should celebrate that. But we shouldn't be attached to it.
Right.
But, you know, I'm driving along, going nowhere.
Right.
And which means I'm not driving. So I actually get out of the car and take a picture. I put it on Instagram, you saw it. So that was a moment where it's okay. But in the next moment, I start grumbling to my husband and say, "You're a backseat driver." You know? And he's telling me, "Why don't you go in that other lane?" And I just immediately So, you know, just seeing clearly, and feeling what I feel, mm-hmm. then by seeing clearly the energy behind it, the way in which we perpetuate our suffering and follow mm-hmm. that train wreck of attachment to our ideas, mm-hmm. our opinions, our feelings, okay, maybe he's not a backseat driver. Maybe he's just had a good idea. So in these very simple, ordinary ways it can come up, yes.
I was just thinking of, again, relationships. Mm-hmm. I suppose in my experience, the thing that is sort of the scariest is when you encounter a relationship where one or both of you is attached to an illusion or an image of the other, mm-hmm. or you get like pigeonholed in this box and you can't ever leave it. Mm-hmm. And I think that to me is like the bad attachment. That's like where you don't want to be. But saying like I love you as a person, mm-hmm. and whoever that person is, I'm choosing to love them as they grow and not this fixation or this pictured image of who you are now. Mm-hmm.
That seems very well phrased in terms of really talking about the difference between this small-minded attachment.
Right, and it does, it feels small inside, mm-hmm. of, you know, if you, I'm sure we've experienced relationships like that where you're just like, wow, I just feel so cramped in here, there is no place for me anymore. Mm-hmm. The oxygen is left. Mm-hmm. I can't grow from here. You know? Mm-hmm. And then the opposite of that being very much like, wow, I just shit.
Yeah, and you know the always the I feel you know in terms of a long term relationship, and anybody who likes to please weigh in on this that there's that space to have it all different ways and to recover. You know, just as I was talking about this simple little stuck in traffic mind. You know, we do that with each other. My husband, thankfully, did not start calling me names when I called him a backseat driver. He's a much better practitioner than I am. You know, just, again, spaciousness of mind and the temptation, to, especially in long-term relationships, where that habit energy, the way that we can, you know, we kind of put ourselves in pigeonholes and we put the other ones. Oh, you know, my husband, he's this, this, this. My wife's this, this, this. We have to watch that and, again, being able to see clearly and not get carried away by attachments to our ideas rather than our big attachment, which is love.
Yeah. I just want to weigh in on one thing. I thought your example of, I think we've all been in our version of the Mercer mess from one time or another, but you know, sometimes we can talk about attachment in kind of this general theoretical way, and I think we can trip all over it. But just going back to Buddha's original question of why is there suffering and where does it come from? This is one of the things that he pointed to. So you want to get home. It takes you a half hour to go to a pool. Suffering appears. Mm-hmm. If we're not aware of our attachments, that's when things like road rage happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to pick things mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. hopefully sound absurd to everybody in this room, but it's not that uncommon. So seeing the source of that suffering as not just separate from us, but seeing our participation in it is, I think, helps me when I think about attachment. And I don't know if we have to get as caught up in the theoretical idea of is attachment good, is attachment bad. It's a source of dis-ease that we have. And if we're not suffering right now, then attachment probably isn't a problem. But it might be at some point. So just thinking about that context of why we talk about attachment.
you know, I would like to bring up something that's, I was really inspired by what you said about this, if a child from 1 to 2 has a foundation, a strong foundation, and that can carry them through any number of things later on. Maybe I'd like to ask you what you think about this in terms of you know, you mentioned don't know mind, but in terms of our relationships with others, you know, having had 3 children, it strikes me that it's this unconditional love, and you know, it can come out in all kinds of weird ways, but I don't know, I guess I'm curious, as a psychiatrist, do you, what do you think?
I think that's what is, people recognize as a remarkable thing about experience of being parents, just from talking with people. I haven't had that experience myself, so. But it's a dyad, or a triad, depending on. It's usually a parent and child, and for a while there's not really any separation there, I think that for many people feels wonderful, and that it's a bit of a loss when that separation starts to happen. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity for a lot of people, I think, to experience not just being about themselves, that there's, you know, another person that is not all that. There's not a separation. There's not, I'm a person, they're a person, that we're just one. I don't know if that was your question.
No, that was. And, you know, then it seems to me we could extrapolate from that in terms of our practice. And, you know, we talk about don't know mind as becoming one. Becoming one. And maybe we can take mother and child or father and child as a metaphor for that moment, that giving birth to this oneness. I remember being, when my first child was born, struck by that oneness and also by almost an immediate sense of loss, of separation, that he was not then, you know, then experiencing some pain that I was not my own. It's very rich territory, this love stuff, this big love.
Oh,
how is it alive in your life right now?
Yeah, maybe I didn't follow that rule, but it probably is alive in my life right now.
Good answer.
Well, I mean, besides, like, you know, we're all attached. I know, I got it. But, you know, is there something specific that you're attached to that brought on wanting to give this talk?
Well, it's that recognition, I think, of what I was talking about, is of being stuck in my own thinking, and sort of how can I, how to get a little distance from that, at least, And I'm looking forward to this retreat starting tomorrow. I've found those very helpful and to be able to accomplish that and in the past. So it's just a little bit more time to watch that going on. And for me, as Lisa said, I just quit my job. I'm unemployed for the first time in decades, and so it's kind of a new experience. And there's nothing I really have to worry about or attend to right away to make sure that that I have a place to live and eat and stuff like that. So that's a real luxury, but it's a big change. There's all these connections with people I had at work, and just suddenly that's stopped. And I got very used to just always having to check the email all the time, and now I can't. And it's mostly a good thing, but I recognize how much that became part of sort of who I was and what I was doing all the time. And so this attachment book by John Bowlby is the first of a trilogy, and the other two were Separation and Loss. So I'm experiencing separation from this this experience. It was such a big part of my life for a very long time, and I'll probably be returning to it in some way, but
last chance. Please feel comfortable. Something you'd like to bring up, not necessarily a question. Offering. I think it's very rare that it feels to me rare that here we are, a group of people that are willing to take on this, these questions, these big questions, in a very whole body, heart, mind way. I really do think that it's exceptional. And I also think it's exceptional that we're alive at all. that our heart is set on waking up, on doing the right thing, of being of service, is extraordinary. And I'm convinced that the repercussions already are huge. So maybe I could just end with a thank you. Thank you for your inquiring hearts and minds and your dedication.
Thank you.
So we have a retreat, like Jim said, tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. Please be on your cushion at 6. So we need to get here a little early, get your bowls, but I'm looking forward to it. And then Buddha's Enlightenment Day is Sunday morning, so we'll have a ceremony at 9:30 a.m. followed by potluck and Sangha board meeting. So please come in today.